Okay, let's unpack this. We've got a stack of recent research sources here, and they're diving into some really complex corners of computational mathematics.
Yeah, definitely. We're talking polynomial systems, matrices, algorithms.
Yeah.
Quite a range.
What's really fascinating, and it seems to be the core idea kind of weaving through these papers, is the shift in perspective.
Exactly. It's not always about bracing for the absolute worst-case scenario in math, you know, that theoretical nightmare input.
Right, the one that might need impossible precision or just take forever to compute.
Instead, these researchers are looking at what happens in, let's say, typical situations.
How are they doing that? Is it about adding randomness?
Yeah, often by introducing randomness or looking at how systems behave when there's a little bit of noise or variation, much more like real-world data.
Okay, so our mission in this deep dive is really to pull out the key insights from these sources.
What are the big questions they're asking? What surprising results do they get by looking beyond that worst case?
And crucially, why does this different way of thinking matter for you, the listener? Whether you're working with data, algorithms, or just interested in complex systems.
We'll explore how things like probability, geometry, and some new analytical tools are giving us a, well, a more realistic picture.
So we'll start with sensitivity, then maybe how many solutions you typically expect.
Then pivot to large random matrices, and finally, look at algorithms and even tensors through this lens.
All right. Sounds like a plan. Grab your favorite beverage, everyone, and let's jump in.
Let's kick off with wrestling with these sensitive systems, specifically finding the roots, the solutions of polynomial systems.
Okay, and this first source tackles a fundamental challenge there, right? Sensitivity.
Exactly. When you're finding roots, the solutions can be incredibly sensitive to tiny changes in the coefficients, the numbers defining the system.
A small wobble sends the root flying off.
Pretty much. That sensitivity is captured by something called a condition number.
Okay, high condition number, high sensitivity, like standing on a wobbly table.
That's a good analogy, yeah. A tiny nudge has huge consequences. For math, it means you need immense precision just to get a reliable answer.
And the worst case scenarios here are pretty bad, I gather.
Oh, yeah. Some systems are so sensitive, the number of digits of accuracy you'd need to even tell their roots apart can grow exponentially with the number of variables.
Which is just completely impractical for computation.
Totally impractical. But again, that's the edge case, the worst possible setup.
So the idea here is, what if the system isn't designed to be awful, but is random?
Exactly. Can we get a better sort of probabilistic handle on these condition numbers?
Hadn't people looked at this before? Random systems.
Yes, there was previous work, some probabilistic estimates for condition numbers, but they were often quite limited.
Limited how?
Well, they often required the coefficients to come from very specific random distributions, like certain symmetric Gaussian models, and mostly for square systems.
Square systems meaning same number of equations as variables.
Right, and equations and variables.
So what's the breakthrough in this paper then?
They managed to establish new probabilistic estimates for condition numbers that apply much more broadly.
Okay, broader in what way?
Two key ways the source really highlights. First, their estimates work for a much wider family of distributions for how those random coefficients are chosen. You're not stuck with just those few special models.
That sounds more flexible. And the second way.
Second, and this is really important for practical applications, they extended the results to include overdetermined systems.
Ah, more equations than variables.
Exactly. M equations and variables, where M is bigger than N1.
Okay, wait, why does that matter so much?
It's super common in fields like data science, signal processing. Think about reconstructing an image from tons of noisy measurements.
Ah, right. You might have way more measurements equations than the number of pixels variables you're trying to find.
Precisely. And until this work, there wasn't really a good way to get these probabilistic condition number estimates for that MN1 scenario.
Which you need to know how much you can trust the results in those data-rich problems.
Exactly. So the takeaway is, for a large class of random polynomial systems, including those important overdetermined ones, they found bounds on the expected condition number, or technically its logarithm.
And these bounds are predictable.
Yeah, they depend polynomially on the size and complexity, like n and the degree d, things like n log plus d log n. And for those overdetermined systems where m is proportional to n, their estimates are actually shown to be close to optimal.
Close to optimal, meaning you probably can't get much tighter bounds.
That's the idea. It's a big step towards understanding the typical difficulty you face, not just the theoretical worst case.
That makes sense. Practical versus purely theoretical.
And the source also mentions they developed a useful analytical tool, extending an idea about the derivative of a single polynomial to whole systems. A nice bonus.
Okay, so building on that, sensitivity of roots. Let's shift to a related question.
Yeah.
Just how many real roots does a system even have?
Right. This next source looks at that for a special kind called funomials.
Funomials. The name kind of gives it away.
It does. They're polynomials defined by having a limited number of terms, or monomials.
Even if the powers in those terms are really high.
Exactly. You could have variables by 1, by 2, by 3, but the polynomial might only have, say, 3 terms, maybe by 110, by 25, plus by 320, plus a constant. The degree could be 20, but there are only 3 terms. Few terms.
Okay. And the standard bounds on the number of real solutions usually depend on the degree, right? Which would be huge here.
Astronomical, sometimes. And again, that feels like a worst-case estimate that might not reflect reality for systems that naturally have few terms, maybe from physics or sparse models.
So the research idea was, look at random funomials.
Pretty much. Study the expected number of real solutions, specifically positive ones, for random funomial systems. They modeled it by assuming the coefficients of those few terms are random Gaussians.
And what did they find? Was it surprising?
I'd say so. They found an upper bound on the expected number of positive real zeros.
Okay.
That depends only on the number of exponent vectors, which is basically just the number of terms you have.
Wait, only on the number of terms, not the degree at all.
Not on the degree at all. That's the kicker.
Wow. So you can have these crazy high powers, but if there are only, say, 5 terms.
The expected number of real solutions is bounded by something related to 5. Not related to those huge powers.
That really goes against the grain of the traditional degree-based bounds.
Completely. The source gives examples where their bound might be tiny, like one expected solution, while a degree-based bound for the same system would be massive.
So for these random funomial systems, it's the sparseness, the number of terms, that really dictates the expected number of solutions.
That seems to be the message. The number of ingredients matters more than their individual complexity, on average. Another win for looking at randomness.
Interesting. And the proof used different tools.
Yeah, the source mentions a more combinatorial flavor, using ideas from integral geometry. Shows you need a diverse toolkit for these problems.
Okay, let's switch gears again. From polynomials to linear systems, matrices.
Right. This next source tackles a long-standing problem about the rank of certain matrices.
Which matrices are we talking about?
Random sparse matrices. Matrices where most entries are zero.
And the non-zero entries are placed randomly.
Yeah. According to some random process, often with a fixed number of non-zeros per row or per column, chosen randomly.
And these are important where?
Crucial in many areas. Coding theory is a big one, especially for things like LDPC codes, low-density parity check codes, error correction.
Okay. And why is the rank the key property?
The rank tells you about the independence of rows or columns. It's directly related to the dimension of the null space vectors the matrix sends to zero. For codes, the rank basically determines the code's efficiency, its rate, how much information it can carry reliably.
Got it. But finding the rank wasn't fully understood.
Despite being studied for ages, there wasn't a really comprehensive formula for the rank of these sparse random matrices, especially the general case where you prescribe the number of non-zeros in rows and columns separately.
So the research aimed to find that formula, at least for large matrices.
Exactly. Determine the asymptotic rank, what the rank settles down to as the matrix size gets very, very large.
And they found it.
They did. They provide a formula for this asymptotic rank.
What's remarkable about the formula?
Well, two things really stand out. First, what it depends on.
Which is?
Surprisingly simple. Only the distributions of the number of non-zero entries across the rows and columns. Basically, if you know the average sparsity pattern, you know the rank for a large matrix.
Okay, that is simple. What's the second thing? What doesn't it depend on?
This is maybe even more striking. The source emphasizes the formula is independent of the specific field the matrix entries come from.
So real numbers, binary numbers for codes, other fields, doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. And it also doesn't depend on the specific values of those non-zero entries.
Huh. That feels counterintuitive for a random matrix. You'd expect the rank itself to be a bit random.
Right. But the finding is that the rank converges to a non-random deterministic value.
Why would that happen?
The source connects it to this idea of self-averaging systems. For very large random structures, certain big-picture properties, like rank, become predictable. They average out the small random fluctuations.
Interesting. So large-scale randomness leads to predictability here.
In a way, yes. There's also a neat side note. Their rigorous math result actually contradicts predictions from a non-rigorous physics method, the cavity method for some cases.
Oh, so the math helped clarify where the physics intuition might have gone wrong.
Seems so. It helps pin down the limits and assumptions of that other method.
Did they need special techniques to prove this?
They developed something they call a random perturbation method. By carefully adding a few specific random rows, they could break problematic dependencies in the matrix, short linear relations, without messing up the overall nullity too much. Clever trick.
And connecting back, this rank formula directly gives the rate for certain LDPC codes.
Yep, a direct line from this theoretical insight into the practical performance limits of important communication codes.
Okay, so from the structure of these objects, let's turn to how we actually compute things about them, algorithms and complexity.
Right, and the next sources explore this through that lens of typical rather than worst case performance.
Because standard algorithm analysis is often worst case complexity.
Yeah. Usually, yeah. How long could it possibly take on the hardest input imaginable?
But we've seen that theme. Now, the worst case often doesn't reflect real world performance.
Exactly. An algorithm might have a terrifying theoretical worst case,
yeah,
but be super fast almost all the time.
So the idea is to use different tools to analyze them, like smoothed analysis.
Precisely. Smoothed analysis is a key one. Instead of the single worst input, you look at inputs that have been slightly randomly perturbed or drawn from some distribution. It kind of bridges worst case and average case.
And condition numbers come back in here too.
They do. Condition numbers measure how well-behaved an input is, which often correlates with how fast an algorithm can handle it.
Okay, so these sources give us a couple of examples.
Two great ones. First, the Plantinga-Vetscher algorithm, or PV algorithm.
PV algorithm, what's that used for?
Computational geometry, things like subdividing shapes defined by polynomials, important for graphics, modeling.
And they applied smoothed analysis to it.
They did. They analyzed its complexity number of steps, operations on inputs made of Dobro random polynomials.
Dobro polynomials.
It's a technical term for a specific type of random polynomial model designed to capture a kind of realistic randomness.
And the result, they got expected complexity bounds.
Yeah, probabilistic bounds on the expected complexity under that model. And these bounds depend on things like the condition numbers of the input polynomials.
So it gives you a picture of average performance with some noise or variability.
Exactly. Not just performance on that one pathological input designed to break it. A much more useful measure for predicting practical speed.
Makes sense. What's the second example?
The Descartes solver.
Ah, okay. That sounds familiar. For finding roots of polynomials.
Yep, specifically for isolating the real roots of polynomials with just one variable, univariate polynomials. If you've used software to find roots of, say, by 3, 2x plus 5, quiz 0, chances are a version of Descartes was involved.
And it's known for being fast in practice.
Remarkably fast.
Uh-huh.
But here's the puzzle. Its theoretical worst-case complexity is quite high.
How high?
For degree and coefficient bit size tau, it's roughly D4 tau2 operations. That's pretty slow on paper.
But it doesn't act that way in reality.
Not at all. So the research applied smoothed analysis to Descartes, specifically for polynomials with integer coefficients.
Okay, using random integer coefficients.
Right. They looked at random bit polynomials. Coefficients are random integers up to a certain size tau.
And the result. Did smoothed analysis explain the speed?
It did, beautifully.
Oh.
They found the expected bit complexity under this random model is much, much better, roughly D2 plus D tau.
Wow, compared D2 plus D tau to D4 tau2, that's a huge difference.
Massive difference. This probabilistic bound really helps explain the Descartes solver's practical speed. It shows those terrible worst-case inputs must be incredibly rare, at least under this natural random model.
So the typical performance captured by smoothed analysis is way closer to what people actually observe.
Exactly. It shows these tools, smoothed analysis, condition numbers are really invaluable for bridging that gap between theory and practice and algorithm performance. Gives us a more nuanced, often more optimistic view of computation.
Okay, fascinating. For our final dive, let's look at another complex object, tensors.
Right. Specifically, symmetric tensors and something called their symmetric tensor rank, or SRANK.
Okay, conceptually, what is SRANK? Decomposing the tensor.
Yeah. Think of it like trying to break down a complex symmetric polynomial into a sum of simpler pieces, specifically powers of linear forms, like expressing a complicated shape as a sum of simple building blocks.
Mm-hmm.
We're focusing on using real components here.
But finding the exact rank is hard.
Incredibly hard, often intractable. And for many tensors, the exact rank can be very high, growing really quickly with the tensor size and order.
So the question becomes, what if we allow a bit of error? Approximation.
Exactly. That's the idea behind approximate symmetric tensor rank.
So instead of the exact decomposition, you find a low rank tensor that's close to the original one.
Right. Within some tolerance level, let's call it epsilon, and you measure closeness using a mathematical norm.
And the research question is, how does this approximate rank behave? Is it much lower?
Can it be much lower? And the findings are a definite yes. The source shows the approximate rank can be significantly different from, and often much lower than, the exact rank.
Especially for tensors where the exact rank is known to be really high.
Particularly then. They established upper bounds for this approximate rank. These bounds depend on properties of the tensor itself, measured by certain norms.
Okay.
And crucially, on that tolerance epsilon you're willing to accept.
Can you give an example of the difference?
They give examples where the exact rank might grow really fast with dimension n, something like n to the power d1, but the approximate rank is bounded much better, maybe like n to the d2 divided by epsilon squared.
That's a huge improvement if n and d are large.
It's a dramatic difference. Mm. It suggests that even a tensor of the very complex exact structure might be well represented by a much simpler one if you allow just a small approximation error.
Which seems really relevant for data analysis where things are often noisy or approximate anyway.
Absolutely crucial. And they don't just show these bounds exist. The source also provides algorithms, things like energy increment, sparsification, Frank-Wolf, designed to actually find these low-rank approximations.
So it's computationally feasible to get these good approximations?
It demonstrates feasibility, yes. Finding the absolute optimal approximation is still hard, but finding a good low-rank approximation is possible.
Which reinforces that whole theme again, approximation, randomness. They often reveal simpler structures.
It's a consistent thread, definitely. Looking beyond the exact worst-case scenario often leads to more manageable and practical insights.
So let's try and bring it all together. We've looked at polynomial sensitivity, funomial solutions, sparse matrix rank, algorithm complexity, tensor approximation. What's the common thread?
I think it's really the power and the practical value of looking beyond the absolute worst-case scenario.
Which is vital. Worst-case analysis gives guarantees, but...
But it can sometimes paint an overly pessimistic or even impractical picture of how things behave in the real world, which is often messy, random, approximate.
Right. We saw analyzing random polynomial systems gives a more applicable handle on sensitivity, even for those overdetermined systems in data science.
Mm. And for funomials, the expected number of solutions being controlled by the number of terms, not the degree that's really counterintuitive, but revealing.
And the rank of large, random, sparse matrices becoming predictable, non-random key for coding theory.
And smooth analysis, explaining why algorithms like Descartes are actually fast, giving realistic complexity bounds that match practice much better than the worst-case theory.
And finally, complex tensors being well approximated by simpler ones, if you allow a little tolerance.
Yeah, all these tools, probability, randomness, average case, smoothed analysis, condition numbers, approximation, they're giving us crucial insights into typical behavior.
How these math objects and algorithms behave with realistic inputs, noise, the kinds of scenarios we actually encounter.
Gives us a more accurate picture, often a more optimistic one, really. It helps build more reliable systems, understand the true computational cost in practice.
So it leads to a final thought, maybe for you, the listener, to ponder.
What other areas of math may be areas currently facing seemingly impossible barriers based on worst-case thinking?
Might reveal simpler truths if we just shifted perspective slightly,
yeah.
Looked beyond the absolute edge cases to the more probable realities.
It's a powerful lens to apply.